Welcome, Dumbheads, to MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. In this series, we're examining every single goddamn page of Alien Hunger, a quick start adventure for Vampire the Masquerade, to determine what is the dumbest thing on that page. Every episode is one page, every episode is short. If you'd like to play along at home, this is 1991's Alien Hunger, the official PDF release from White Wolf. Today we're wrapping up Alien Hunger. We've finished the book. It's the end of this leg of the season. More on that later. And it's time to just take a moment to reflect back on, what the fuck happened here. You know, we were promised a story. I guess that's the grievance that I want to lodge right off the bat. We were told that we were going to engage in an exercise in personal horror storytelling. And I guess it's been personal. You know, we got to know these characters. There's been a little horror, you know? There was a smoke-filled basement. A kid almost died. We had a hallucination that someone was a hot dog and probably ate them. I mean, we encountered Prince Ed and found out that, counter to much of vampire fiction, much of vampire lore, if you live for centuries and centuries, your body may be preserved, unaging. But your coolness is not. You gradually become more and more of a goober, start to develop this Jim Belushi-like patina. So I guess it's been horrible in that sense. But I defy you to tell me that this book contained a story. It did contain other things, though. It contained some stuff. Not all of it was bad. And so here's what I want to do. For this wrap-up episode, I'm not going to go into great, great detail. In past seasons, I've done things like identifying exactly how I would run a story, you know, what I would change, kind of come up with a rewrite and alternate way to approach the story. I don't want to get into that in detail, partly because we do have more business to take care of this season. There's going to be more coming, and so this isn't like, you know, a big grand wrap-up of everything. What I'm going to do is take a more holistic approach to this book, talking a little bit about the different parts in it that I think don't fit together. And I think that's the core issue with Alien Hunger, not just in identifying problems with it, which, you know, we've been doing for many weeks now, but also in picking out what does work and what could work in a different context. I think we can kind of wrap all that up just by talking about these different parts of the book and kind of like which parts of Alien Hunger are fighting other parts. Once we've taken care of that, we've got just a couple of other orders of business. Number one, we followed Vampire Drama Club all the way through this book, and I want to talk quickly about where they all end up at the end of this story. You know, how these characters developed, what their character sheets look like at the end of this, what their goals are, their vampire hopes and dreams. Then after that, I'll tell you what's coming next on Mega Dumbcast and when you can expect it to hit the feed after a very short hiatus. So let's get started with parts of Alien Hunger. The way I see it, we got basically four different things happening in Alien Hunger. These things are carried off with different degrees of success, but I think, number one, none of them are as much of a shambles independently as this entire book is as a whole. And number two, I think in many cases, what's fucking up one element of the book is another element of the book. And maybe we can kind of pick those apart and break this book down into its decently functioning components. You know, let's be honest, this car is a lemon. I'm not going to tell you to go drive it around anywhere, but maybe you can sell these hubcaps. That is the silver lining that I'm offering you. So here's the first thing I think is happening in Alien Hunger. The value proposition. This is what Alien Hunger purports to be, what it is for. And this has got some subparts in it, but as much as it is in my nature to always include sub-bullet points on a bullet point list, we just don't have time for this in this episode, so I'm going to kind of merge all these together. Alien Hunger is an introduction to vampire for players, so it's meant to be your first vampire story, starts quickly, the GM doesn't need to know anything about the game ahead of time, the storyteller doesn't need to be an experienced storyteller, the players don't need to know the setting or anything, you just jump right in. And the story introduces you to the game. And the way that Alien Hunger is meant to achieve that is by telling a certain kind of story. The story where you go from being human through your embrace into your early days as a vampire. And so rather than, as is the case in many vampire campaigns, starting as existing vampire characters who already have sort of like a backstory, an established place in the world of darkness, you're playing characters who are being introduced along with you, the player, into that world. So that's the value proposition. That's the premise. The second thing, the plot. Basically, vampire Louis Pasteur embraces a bunch of fledglings in Denver, Colorado, using experimental blood potions instead of conventional vampire embrace. This upsets the prince, creates a kind of hazy conflict between these new vampires and the prince of the city, and it leaves behind a collection of potions that might alter the vampiric curse, especially for player characters. So Louis Pasteur leaves behind the legacy of these blood potions that could maybe change the character's clan, etc., etc., and that are part of his project to cure vampirism, which in the climax of the story might actually work for one or more of the player characters. The third element we have here, the player characters, the pregens. This is a story specifically about these characters. Now, you can make original characters, either in addition to or instead of these pregens, but a lot of the book is devoted to these pregens, laying out their backstories, their connection to one another, the way that they tie into Prester, like why Louis Pasteur picked them, what their connection is to him, and implicitly and explicitly, there's a bunch of stuff in the book about how these characters will experience this story, so that's kind of like the personal side. There's the plot, but then there's also what these characters experience in their transformation, and it's kind of tied up with who the pregens are. Finally, we've got the mood, and what Alien Hunger wants to achieve, and I know this only because it told me so hard what it was going to do that I still remember, even after dozens of pages of the book failing to show me in any way. What the book told me it was going for on mood was goth punk desperation, alienation, and a theme of change. So, all right, taking these one at a time. The value proposition. This is a good idea for a vampire supplement. For the World of Darkness, which is, you know, it's a world much like our own, but there's also a lot of specific information about the setting that you need to know to function in the campaign. It's a good idea to have an introductory adventure that kind of takes you on a tour and leads you as a player through what you're going to need to know to effectively play the game and to get the most out of it. And a really good way to do that is the other part of the value proposition here, which is an introductory adventure where you go from being a human to being a vampire. Because then you're playing a character who doesn't know shit, so then you don't have to pretend to not know shit. You really don't know shit. And so you can method act your way through not knowing what the fuck Vampire the Masquerade is to kind of sort of understanding what Vampire the Masquerade is enough to function in this world and like pick up the rest as you go. Good premise for a supplement. I'm not sure this book is a great introduction to vampire though, and I'm not just talking about the quality of the quote unquote story or whatever. I think the fact that it fails so hard on mood, it does not feel like dark and goth punk and cool or any of that, and its plot doesn't really address the key elements of the transition into being a vampire. I think it's really this book's failure specifically on mood and plot that mess with the premise here, because the storyline is, I mean, you get turned into a vampire. I'll give the author that. It said you were going to turn into a vampire, and you sure did. You became a vampire. So this is technically a Vampire the Masquerade adventure. But if what we want to do is the story of, you know, you are transformed, and then you go through all the early days stuff, like what it is to be a vampire, especially a new vampire in the World of Darkness in this setting, it's missing so many of the key elements. Like, you don't have a sire, really. Like, you don't have a vampire who embraced you, who you have a relationship with, which is key to the fiction that inspired Vampire the Masquerade, as well as Vampire the Masquerade moving forward. You kind of have this NPC in Ed, who is an unmotivated antagonist, who then at the end of the story kind of solves all your problems with relation to, like, you're being investigated by the cops, you kind of have this uncertain social standing in this pecking order in the city. You may have fucked up something with the masquerade, and now either somebody's after you over it, or you need to like fix it in a hurry. The transition from having a regular human life into figuring out how you're going to sort of spend your eternity and how you're going to come live among the denizens of the night. You can't really do that because the denizens of the night are hunting your ass through almost the entire story. And then once they stop, it's basically over. Like, once you make peace with Prince Ed, there's not really any time or opportunity for you to integrate yourself into the vampire world of Denver, because it's immediately off to Science Jaguar, Klondike, drink a bunch of blood potions, game over. So you kind of don't get to engage the core elements of Vampire the Masquerade as a distinct role-playing game, as a distinct expression of vampire stories. So I think if you played through all this and then you're like, okay, great, I get vampire. Now I'm going to go play some other vampire campaign. Now that I get it, play a different character. You wouldn't get it. You wouldn't know like how clan dynamics work, what your relationship with your sire is, what your relationship is supposed to be with the prince and like to the people in the rest of the city, how to deal with the masquerade on a night-to-night basis. All that stuff is left out here. So I think that's the biggest problem on like the value proposition part. The characters, on the other hand, like the pregens, I think are fine for exploring this. I can imagine a version of this where it's just Vampire Drama Club. You can add an original character into the mix if you want. They get embraced by either one sire or their respective sires or whatever, and then shit happens, and it's just basic vampire shit. It's like dealing with all the core elements of the Vampire the Masquerade setting, so that the story really is just like, welcome to the world of darkness. This is the bullshit you put up with as a vampire. I think that would be fun. I think that would be useful. And what's great about it is you actually don't need Louis Pasteur involved at all. It just could be Vampire the Masquerade, no Louis Pasteur content whatsoever. Because I do feel like that's kind of a distraction. Like, you know, you're trying to deal with the loss of your mortality. You're a little bit distracted. And I feel like, I mean, if nothing else, you're kind of wasting a reveal here that Louis Pasteur still exists, is a vampire, and is working on curing vampirism. That's a lot to wrap my head around on the same week that I'm like, oh, wait, okay, wait, so I drink blood now? Speaking of Louis Pasteur, then we got the plot. The plot of this adventure. A desperately egregious mismatch with everything else this adventure is trying to do. Which isn't to say it isn't fun. Vampire Louis Pasteur, yes. The Terminator, yes. Columbo, yes. None of these things are bad. I would love for this story to have more structure. I would love for there to be more of a beginning, middle, and end, and for it to be a little more satisfying. But a lot of the stuff that happens and the premise of there is this vampire who's working on a cure for vampirism and has left behind sort of his notes, his work, like even these like potions he made that can affect the curse in a way that people haven't seen before. That's all really cool. I don't love Denver. I don't love Gothpunk Denver. And I don't love Prince Ed and the other vampires of Denver. But I think if they were better, if those NPCs were better, then this plot would hang together a lot better, would be more interesting. So there's nothing like fundamentally wrong with the plot here. The thing is, though, it's campy as hell, and it really relies on you to understand what the status quo of the world of darkness is. There's nothing interesting about Vampire Louis Pasteur. Well, hold on. I tell a lie. There will always be something interesting about Vampire Louis Pasteur. You can't even say the phrase without your eyes twinkling just a little bit. But there's nothing interesting on like a storytelling or setting level about Vampire Louis Pasteur working on a cure for vampirism if you don't understand the status quo of the setting, that like there is no cure for vampirism. And there are these elders who would be invested in preventing there from being a cure for vampirism. And there's all this politics happening all the time. It's this chessboard that you're on. And so this person who's like trying to do this really difficult thing and change the curse is caught up in the intrigue of undead politics, and like all this stuff is going to be fully lost on you if you don't know what Vampire the Masquerade is. So it's the wrong plot for an introductory adventure like this. And I think specifically tying it to these pregens and to the city of Denver significantly undercuts it. You could have set this in just like any goth punk town USA. You know, you could have given, I think, as I mentioned before, some resources for the players to run it in their own hometown, if that's what you want to do. At least make it applicable to any of the big vampire cities, you know, make it applicable to Chicago or New York or New Orleans, and have a story that can kind of be set anywhere. This story is very Denver specific, needlessly, not really because of Denver per se, but because of this whole setup where it's like there's this whole NPC cast. We know who the prince is. We know all the different kind of power players, and you can't really add more to the story without fucking up the story. Because like if there's someone else you can go to, like another faction you can align with who's opposed to Edward, then it changes everything about the way this proceeds. So it's not easy to move this story to another city, either one from another vampire product or your own hometown or wherever else you might want to set it, which is a problem for a story like this that is basically a romp. And it would be really fun if you could just have Louis Pasteur show up and stir up shit in whatever city you're telling vampire stories in. That would be great. Also, needless to say, mood-wise, if what we're going for is goth punk desperation, alienation, and a theme of change, Vampire Louis Pasteur making magic vampire potions just does not, Vampire Louis Pasteur just, he's not the instrument to do this kind of deep, dark storytelling. So the plot is fighting the mood as well. Then we got the characters, the pregens. I like Vampire Drama Club. I have to say, I like Vampire Drama Club, and I like the option to create an original character that ties into the pregens. I really appreciate that as something that would serve a lot of player groups, where some people would want to play a pregen, other people would want to play an original character. Having the ability to do both and have that kind of like meld together is great, and it kind of creates a nucleus for the group to cluster around. So like if you did just what I did in the season, where one person wants to be an original character and then everybody else wants to be pregens, you've kind of got this cluster of like Emerson, Community Theater, Teresa and Flash's business. All that stuff, kind of like there's this stuff to glom onto that you can attach your original character to and have a strong core to the group that explains why all these people are hanging out together, basically, which is going to be great for like group cohesion and making this all work. So well done on the characters. I don't know that having this big pregen focus is necessarily the best choice for this like humans become vampires story. That seems more like the kind of thing where you want to do character creation. More importantly, though, none of these characters meaningfully tie into this plot. They tie into the situation. They tie into Prester a little bit. There's a reason why Louis Pasteur chooses them, kind of. But none of these characters have any motivations or abilities or interests or anything really that ties into the plot of the story, except for Teresa being a chemist. And I guess Monica being a DA, and then there's a police investigation into the group, but that's more of like a thing that seems like it should matter and doesn't, more than an actual organic tie-in, because there's no way for Monica really to engage with that, I feel. The whole police thing, Vampire Drama Club can't really solve it. Ultimately, it's Edward who makes it go away. And it's kind of interesting how Monica could negotiate around like her husband, who's a police officer, but there's no real content about that presented in the book. I don't really see a way to negotiate it in a way that leverages Monica's character to engage with the plot. And a lot of that comes from the fact that the police investigation angle is just so thin. Like, this book sicks Columbo on you and then basically says he continues to follow you around and ask questions for a while, and then an NPC makes him go away. And there's really nothing else there. And finally, the mood. I mean, the mood is obviously nothing in this book conveys the mood that is described to us at the beginning of the book. There is not a goth punk feel here. There's one goth club, and it's a little bit gothy, but there's nothing cool here. There's nothing grim here. There's nothing sort of desperate. There's nothing like very raw and modern and early 90s here. It doesn't feel up to date. This theme of alienation, I don't know. I mean, I guess on a very basic level, any story where you find out that you got to go drink blood now, it's like, all right, you're having a weird day. I have to admit, it would be a little alienating, but that's baked into the game. What this book itself gives us really does not capitalize on that at all, other than very early in the story advising the storyteller to like make heartbeat sounds, keep reminding everybody that they're hungry for the great taste of ladies. There really could have been something here if you had focused the story on, for example, Monica's husband, and you had kind of fleshed out, how does he react to all this? How does he deal with the fact that he's a police officer dealing with this big police investigation into his wife, and there's something up with his wife, and he doesn't know what, and now she's kind of got to lie to him, and she may try to use him to get out of the investigation. You could have worked on telling that story, but instead, the game has us out here, you know, dicking around at lame bars, sneaking into a ranch-style house to fight a squirrely little dirt man with a smoke grenade. Like, none of this is really, like, plucking that chord for me of poignant goth punk horror. The only part of this book, really, that approaches getting the mood or the themes right is the character write-ups for Prince Ed's ghouls, who are so incongruous with and disconnected from the rest of this adventure that I think most of the time, if you ran Alien Hunger, you would never encounter those characters in any capacity, let alone figure out what their deal is and, like, know their dark and twisted backstories. I know I said I wasn't going to do, like, a fully developed alternate idea for Alien Hunger, and I'm not, but if you really just wanted to get mood right and you had to use this book for some weird Iron Chef reason, like, okay, you got to run a vampire campaign based on official material around the moods and themes of goth punk desperation, alienation, and change, what I would maybe do is have the player characters start out as regular mortals or ghouls who are in some capacity working for Prince Ed, knowingly or otherwise, and who have pre-existing relationships with like Mina, Lucy, Roger, Duke, and then story events make it so that those characters have a chance to be embraced. You know, maybe the prince has just had to do something where he's incurred favors from the elders of the city. And so as part of that arrangement, or like part of forming a new primogen council or something like that, he has extended the opportunity to the elders of the city to embrace from his herd and his, you know, group of servitors, almost as a way of like bonding these vampire clans through marriage. Like, now my ex-ghoul is the child of the Bruja primogen or whatever, to sort of solidify the relationship and unify everyone under the prince. And then your characters are caught in the middle and have to learn like, okay, well, I was, you know, this PI working for this guy named Edward. Now I find out he's a vampire and he has basically traded me to this other vampire on the basis of my years of service, but it's not going to be like it was before. I'm not just working for this guy. I'm going to become a vampire and I have to learn what that means. Figure out like, do I want to go along with this deal? Or am I going to, you know, emphasizing the punk in goth punk, be like, fuck you, I'm a person, not a pawn. I don't work for either of you shitheads. I'm going to get a motorcycle and get the fuck out of Denver and go have Anarch-style or Sabbat-style vampire adventures in California, where we ride motorcycles and kill each other with chainsaws. Or if you want to emphasize the goth side, you know, somebody like Monica, she may not be able to leave the city. She may be too attached to it. And so she ends up in this kind of like tragic situation where she's living in the shadows of her former life. Like, that could work. And then, you, again, as much as I love vampire Louis Pasteur, take Louis Pasteur out of the equation. Like, it's all just a little busy. You know, Louis Pasteur is like one of those hand chairs that you can get, like a bright neon hand chair where you sit your butt down in the palm. It's like, I'm for it. I don't mind sitting down in a hand chair, but whatever decor you have happening around your house right now, it's unlikely you've got a hand chair shaped hole just dying to be filled. There aren't a lot of compelling stories that you dip your finger in the stew of this narrative and give it a taste and think, oh, you know what this needs? Vampire Louis Pasteur. So that's kind of my read on Alien Hunger overall. I think this is a good idea for a book. It is a really fun, campy plot that definitely could use another pass. It could use some revision, some structure, but it's got a lot of good elements in it that would be fun as long as you want to be silly. It's got strong characters who just kind of don't belong in this story. They don't have a lot of points of contact with it. And it was going for a mood that it has utterly failed to deliver on, except in a couple of isolated pockets that most players are going to miss that would need to be heavily emphasized to make this game feel anything like it's supposed to feel. If you wanted to run this, the thing to do would be to pick the piece that you want from this and then rewrite the rest. It's one of those gaming books that is probably much better inspiration than it is to use as written for its intended purpose. Before I get on to announcing what's next for MDC and when that's going to come out, let's talk a little bit about where Vampire Drama Club ends up after the end of this story. And this is going to be relevant because, spoilers for later in this episode, we're going to be following these characters into the next book that we cover. So I want to talk a little about kind of where they spent their experience points and what they were up to over the course of this adventure so that we know like where we leave our protagonists as we move on to the next vampire adventure that we're going to cover. Let's start with Monica. Monica, you'll recall, she became human again at the end of the story. The way I read this story, Monica would have spent a lot of it kind of like lying to her husband. I don't think she's interested in developing her vampire powers at all. So I think she probably bumped her leadership up to 3 early in the story as she sort of like gravitated toward the leadership position in the group and had to learn her dominate abilities better. I think after the encounter with Angel Tony, she knows enough about vampire society, kind of like roughly what's going on, that she knows for sure she can't tell Vince. And so she's going to go to Subterfuge 3 to become a better liar and start like keeping secrets from him more and more. By the end of the story, she's had to probably use her dominate ability to alter memories a lot for her victims, for feeding, and also Vince, so that if he stumbles across evidence of what she really is now, she can mind fuck him and erase those memories. That requires wits, so I think she probably took her wits up to 3. And I think ultimately she takes her stealth from 1 dot to 2 at the end of the story, because if she wants to keep contact with the rest of Vampire Drama Club, she's going to have to be able to meet with them secretly to keep them from getting caught, to avoid a masquerade violation, to keep other vampires from knowing that she was a vampire and now she's human again, which seems like a masquerade issue. So that's pretty simple. That's Monica. Teresa, I think after the encounter with Angel Tony, after finding out that other vampires are after her, Teresa would have picked up Protean 4 so that she can turn into a bat. That allows her to get around a little more inconspicuously and get away from any vampires who come after her. For the same reason, I think she probably goes up to Brawl 2, because she knows that she's going to be in for some fights. At one point, she and Flash get jumped by Rachel. I think after the encounter with Klondike, Teresa would be interested in developing her vampire powers in a way that plays more to her strengths. Because if you look at her stats, like, she's not a natural claw fighter. You know, her character backstory emphasizes that she is, like, a mediator, a very smart and personable individual who uses social interaction and kind of, like, finding consensus to get through things. So I think she's going to develop Presence 1 even before she gets her hands on the blood potions, after she fully develops those. And then, as we know, after she drinks the blood potions, she's going to end up picking up another dot of presence for a total of 2 dots of presence, picking up a dot of dominate, and becoming a Toreador. Yes, I was enough of a dork to track these characters all the way through the story and figure out where they were spending their XP and why at every given moment. And so the way I figured it, Teresa was probably saving for Presence 2 when she got it from a magic potion at the end of the story, because this adventure is oddly D&D. So yeah, like, she was saving up to buy a magic sword and then she found a magic sword. So she's got some unspent experience. Right now she's sitting at like Dominate 1, Presence 2, Protean 4. And now she's a Toreador and she's going to start focusing on her social shit, because like, it's nice to have claws. It's nice to be able to turn into a bat, but that's not really how she rolls. Being a vampire beatstick, on the other hand, is exactly how Flash rolls. And it's much easier to figure all this out for him, because he's dumb. He's simple. I think Flash spends the adventure developing whichever physical discipline is cheapest to buy at any given time. So over the course of the story, I see him bringing his celerity up to 2, then bringing his celerity up to 3, then bringing his potence up to 3, then picking up a dot of fortitude, and then when he drinks the vampire potions at the end, he becomes a caitiff and he picks up another dot of fortitude. So Flash is just straight up picking up celerity, potence, fortitude, and just developing them evenly. Because, like, I mean, the whole story, he has really nothing to contribute except being fast and tough. He has no other way to cope with the situation that he's in, so nice and simple with Flash. Per his write-up, he's someone who pretty quickly takes to being a vampire and likes it, so this is all very simple for him. Marcus is a little more interesting. I think Marcus is going to want to figure out what's happening with the group, especially after meeting Angel Tony and getting, like, kind of a dim outline of how this all works. So I see Marcus actually buying his way up to Occult 5 first thing. Occult 4 is already very good, and as we talked about, it means Marcus did know that vampires were real before this adventure, oddly. With Occult 5, per the text in First Edition Vampire, like, your sire doesn't need to teach you about how vampire stuff works very much. So I think Marcus, with all his pagan contacts, the fact he already had Occult 4, I think with Occult 5, Marcus can pretty much figure out, like, these are the clans, this is how vampire society works. He knows enough people to piece that together, and that's going to be very helpful for him going forward. Also, he's going to discover that there's such a thing as vampire magic. Now, there are no Tremere in this adventure, but there is such a discipline as thaumaturgy, which is blood magic that vampires can do. I think Marcus is going to be keenly interested in that. And so after he picks up Occult 5, I think the one and only thing on his shopping list is thaumaturgy, which works a little differently in First Edition Vampire than later. I think right around the time in the story where Vampire Drama Club runs into Science Jaguar finally, Marcus is going to be able to learn the first dot of thaumaturgy. Now, I know you can't normally learn thaumaturgy without a teacher. It's a carefully guarded secret of the Tremere. But in First Edition, thaumaturgy was much more common. And in the next book we talk about, we're going to get definitive proof that you can learn thaumaturgy without a teacher. So I think if anybody can do it, it is paranormal enthusiast, wannabe occultist, and anime titty figurine purveyor Marcus Smith Kearns. Unfortunately, in this edition of the game, the only thing thaumaturgy 1 allows you to do is rituals. And I don't think he knows any rituals yet. However, Marcus can then soon pick up Thaumaturgy 2, which allows him to pick up the Path of Blood. And I think he's going to keep developing Path of Blood as much as he can, at least up to Path of Blood 3, which is, without getting into details, it's a magical effect that's going to allow him to feed more easily, like generate extra blood from feeding on animals. Because the thing about Marcus is Thaumaturgy is great, and he's going to develop that. He's got Auspex, which is great, and he's good at Auspex. That doesn't really allow him as a creepy loner to really feed any more easily. He doesn't have Dominate or Presence or Obfuscate. He doesn't have any of the disciplines that kind of, like, give you a good effective way to feed. So I think Marcus is probably chowing down on an awful lot of cows over the course of his vampire existence in Denver. And the best he can do is know the magical ability to multiply the cow blood in his system, to sink his unholy fangs into a cow and then consume from it the strength of not one, but 10. A dozen cows. So between his very elevated intellectual interest in magic and his very basic fundamental need to make the most out of every goddamn drop of disgusting cow blood, Marcus has got to stick with thaumaturgy. I think he's got Path of Blood 2 by the time the adventure is over. And he's going to be in search of more occult knowledge as we move on to the next story with Vampire Drama Club. Finally, Sir Bloodworth. As soon as the police investigation starts, I think Sir Bloodworth, there's just no way around it. He has to be able to disguise himself, so he's going to pick up Obfuscate 3. And at this stage, that doesn't really allow him to disguise himself as other people very effectively. He doesn't really have the abilities for it, but at least he can make himself look different, which is useful when you are famous, handsome, eye-patched, and wanted for murder. After the encounter with Science Jaguar, when the team is gearing up to go raid Klondike's place, I think Sir Bloodworth is going to stay on the Obfuscate train and pick up Obfuscate 4 so that he can walk around invisibly. This is really the next natural step, a key development in his growth as a fighter slash rogue, being able to rogue around invisibly. Not only good for rogue stuff, but then once you invisibly get close to someone, you're in a really good position to kill them with a sword. So this is a very solid, almost inevitable pick for Sir Bloodworth. It does lean more toward the rogue side, though, and I think after seeing the effectiveness of celerity from Flash, potentially from Klondike, depending on how the fuck those stats are supposed to work, Sir Bloodworth is going to be interested in developing celerity next. And while he's saving for that, fortuitously, he's going to drink all those blood potions and get turned into a Toreador, and they have celerity in clan. So by the end of the story, I think he picks up his first dot of celerity, which is going to make him a much more effective fighter. And at that point, I think Sir Bloodworth is eager to get into Toreador disciplines because he would love to be better at finding traps. That could be an Auspex thing. He'd love to get faster with his sword to be a better fighter. That's a celerity thing. And you know what? He's a naturally charming guy with a high appearance. He may even invest in some presents at some point. So I think Sir Bloodworth is very excited to embark on the Toreador Unlife style. I think he likes being a vampire. He likes being a fighter slash rogue. Things really have worked out great for him. He's still fabulously wealthy. The murder charges have disappeared. The world is his oyster. So everything works out fantastically for Sir Bloodworth, the rich old white man. Who would have thought? At this point, Vampire Drama Club is a cohesive unit using Sir Bloodworth's money and connections to secure themselves in a haven, protect their own personal masquerade, and just integrate themselves into undead Denver society, while Marcus continues to explore the more esoteric aspects of vampirism in search of occult secrets, etc., etc. And while he's out being a nerd, Sir Bloodworth, Teresa, and Flash are just living it up as vampire hedonists. And that's where we're leaving off Alien Hunger. The next book that I'll be covering after a short break will be Awakening, Diablerie Mexico. This is another early Vampire the Masquerade adventure, unlike Alien Hunger, but similar in being very uncharacteristic of what Vampire the Masquerade would become. So I think it's going to be really fun, a big change from what Alien Hunger has been. And so it's going to be fun to track these characters from Alien Hunger, which is all fucked up in one way, to Diablerie Mexico, which is all fucked up in a totally different way, and also fucked up in Mexico, which will be a nice change. That next leg of season 6 will begin in April. So on Monday, April 1st, you can expect the first episode to drop. As with all the books that we're going to be talking about this season, there will be spoilers if you go read the book yourself, so I don't recommend it. You can just listen and follow along. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you again to everyone who has stuck with the show through what was a very long hiatus between seasons 5 and 6. I have been really enjoying and appreciating all of the feedback. It's so fucking flattering that so many people were like waiting for the show to come back with no indication that it was going to, and that people just jumped right back on board. I'm so excited about the rest of this season. I cannot wait to follow these characters through all of the goofy bullshit that Vampire the Masquerade has to offer in all its many eras. I'm not going to get into detail right now about what's coming after Awakening, Diablerie, Mexico, but that book will not be the end of this season. But we'll get to that when we get to it. For now, I'm taking a little break until April 1st, and I will see you then in Mexico. This has been Mega Dumbcast. New episodes drop every day except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big megasode on the patrons-only RSS feed. If you'd like to get access to that feed and support the show, go to patreon.com/megadumbcast. Social media was never healthy and is now dying, so if you want to contact me, you can email me. I am megadumbcast@gmail.com. This season's theme song is Suck City by Black Math, whose work you can find at freemusicarchive.org/music/black_math. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.